ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Step inside homes across Australia and you'll see a rich tapestry of family life. There are single parents, child-free couples, and households where three generations live under one roof. And more than ever, there are people living alone. According to the Australian Institute of Family Studies, more than one in four households are now occupied by one person. I'm Anthony Burke, and this is By Design on ABC Radio National. Today, we take you inside the ideas and innovations that could help reshape Australia's housing future. Because, boy oh boy, Australia's housing situation is in deep crisis. Our population is shifting big time. But the way we design and build our homes, that hasn't caught up. This is episode 3 of our series, The Homefront.
Our housing is actually not suitable for this kind of arrangement because we've lost our understanding of how do we actually live with family members. We haven't been building our homes and our houses to suit that because we haven't really needed to in the last, say, 20, 30 years.
Looking back at Australia historically in the 1950s, back then the average size of a home was about 100 square metres. The average occupancy of those homes was about 4.3. And now the average home in Australia is 236 square metres, so over double the size. But our average occupancy has halved, so it's about 2.3. We're taking four times as much house for the same amount of occupant.
And Australians are on the move, shifting house on average once every 11 years. But isn't home meant to be more about putting down roots, finding a community? So, how do we build homes that grow with us, whether we're expanding to fit a family or downsizing to fit a new stage of life? Right now, we're facing serious challenges. Housing affordability, cost of living pressures, climate change and the environmental strain. So, can our homes help shelter us from this storm we've created? The good news is plans for the Australian Dream 2.0 are already on the drawing board. In this episode, I want to explore how housing can better meet the changing needs of our diverse population. Adult children are staying home longer. Elders are moving back in with their grown-up kids. There's a growing number of renters who are missing out on the stability that comes with putting down roots. And then there are the bigger forces shaping our lives: loneliness, climate change, and the rising cost of living. So, is there any way to make housing more affordable, more adaptable, and more connected? It might sound like a lot to ask of the humble home, but I'm optimistic. Let's begin with homes that shelter more than one generation under one roof. We're talking about young adults who stay on after finishing school and older parents who move back in with their middle-aged children. Dr. Edgar Liu from the University of New South Wales City Futures Research Centre has studied multi-generational living in Sydney and Brisbane. He says that while the cost of living pressures often drive these arrangements, families find value in them that goes far beyond financial convenience.
Any kind of financial or economic benefits was quite well down the list. I think it was the fourth or fifth most common reason. The thing that they enjoy the most was the companionship that they have with the rest of the family. For older people in particular, they often talk about, if I don't leave my son, then I probably don't see him as often, maybe a couple of times a year. And certainly when it comes to involving both grandparents and grandchildren, basically all generations talk about, yeah, I really enjoy the fact that I can grow up with my grandmother in the house and passing on family knowledge, family traditions, or even cultural knowledge.
In Melbourne, one family is trying out a shared intergenerational living arrangement.
My name's Marisa. I live with my mum, my husband, and my two girls, who are 12 and 14. And this is my family home, which I've been in since I was two or three, on and off. It's my happy place. Also, my father died over 30 years ago and I enjoy cooking in the same kitchen that he cooked in. And I light a candle and think of him as I cook and think of all the generations of people that have lived here as my grandparents bought the home. I wouldn't be able to afford to rent. So it's actually nice that it works for me in multiple ways. It's great for the girls to grow up with their grandma. It's helpful, like when they were little, if I needed to get milk from the shops, I didn't have to bundle them in a car and get milk. I could leave them with my mum. It's great for her. She gets to spend time with her grandkids and it gives her life. It improves her health and keeps her happy and well.
Okay, Grandma, do you want to play... Grandma, do you want to play Romeo with us?
Yeah, sure.
It would also be very difficult for her to live independently if we weren't here. So she's a lot happier being in the family home with us around rather than being in some sort of retirement home.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Oops, oh, I dropped one, sorry. My name is Rose Bongiorno. I'm 86, going on 87. I live with my daughter, her husband, and her two children, and we often play games together.
Okay.
You start. Oh, lucky you.
Okay, next person's turn.
The space is great. So my husband and girls and I are mainly upstairs. That's where we sleep. But we do interact a lot with my mum downstairs. But when we need our own space, we can retire to our own space, and I think that's what keeps a happy household.
3 11s, and they're all different colours, so they go together. And then I added it on a 10 to Emily's, because you can have, like, 4 max if they're all different colours.
It's good for the different generations to mix because we can share stories. I can see the different ways they do things these days from when I was their age.
Sharing a home with older generations brings mutual benefits. Let's hear now from another family, this time in Sydney.
Yeah. Let's go and meet my mum.
Leah and Lou live on the top floor of a duplex with Leah's parents, who are in their 80s, on the bottom floor. Lou's 20-year-old niece, Jenna, also lives with them.
Well, actually, it was Lou that came up with the idea. I mean, she thought it was a great idea that they move in downstairs. She could see that Brisbane would be challenging after a while, especially for me. How am I going to get up at short notice? I have other siblings, but they don't live in Brisbane either. And it did feel like it was going to fall at some point on me to care for them. So getting them here sooner rather than later was a great idea because
you get to enjoy them while they're still quite lively, to be honest. Yeah, they still get about out and about and do a lot of things. So it's not, and you know, just Margaret's cooking is outstanding. So we get to benefit from there. And Dennis makes lovely lunches sometimes when you're out working in the garden, so we have a good benefit there with their care back to us, really.
Hi, darling. Do you want to come down and have a cup of tea?
Yes, sure.
Okay, right out. Right, I'll put the kettle on.
Well, how Mum always makes a better cup of tea than I do.
Mm. You only think that because somebody else makes it.
I can see my mum brighten up so much in this environment that she's not only got me around, but, you know, Lou's niece, who she seems to have this really separate and lovely relationship with, that she just glows and I can see it, and I feel like that's something you would never get that just by visiting randomly. Like, it does need to be a situation where you see one another regularly, and that there's sort of a sharing of meals and a sharing of things that you do together, and or not together, but just, you know, Jenna's off for a night out and she'll go down and show Mum her outfit, and Mum loves that. Like, she just loves it. Yeah, little tiny things of life that you would miss if you weren't living, you know, so close together.
I love that, the little tiny things of life. It's the kind of human connection that only comes from living side by side. On ABC Radio National, this is By Design and Episode 3 of The Homefront, our series exploring the ideas, designs and policies shaping the future of housing in Australia. I'm Anthony Burke. And it's exactly that type of connection that inspired researcher and Churchill Fellow recipient Savannah Fischel to visit 54 intergenerational homes across the US and Australia to understand how families live, adapt and thrive together.
I've met people who have been unhoused and found it through social housing. I've met extremely wealthy people who are feeling disconnected with their huge house living in the middle of nowhere, and people across the spectrum. In a nutshell, I would say the benefits for parents are choosing living more communally to have a village-like support system, which makes childcare actually more affordable and less isolating and doable. Yeah, exactly. And then for older adults, it's obviously often about reduced loneliness. Often people have lost someone, but also there's informal support networks. And this is something I talk about a lot, often because we've lost kind of an art of neighbouring. We've lost this natural web of care. So if people don't have those small check-in moments, that ride to the hospital, these small things, they have to wait until something gets serious enough to go and get the authorities, social services, whoever involved. So there's that web of care. For young people, they gain a huge amount. They gain access to mentorship, role models, shared skills, shared amenities. And then for broader society, this is why I think that we need to be really supporting and advocating for communal living models, is because climate resilience comes through people having this community support around them. People are sharing their resources. We just don't have the resources to all have separate everything, separate washing machines, all of these things that sit there. And then we need to think differently about the space that we have and sustainability. And then there's benefits for broader society as well. Some of these communities may be really expensive, but I purposely have tried to feature lots in my output beyond the white picket fence, which have affordability mechanisms built in or are specifically for people on low-income backgrounds. And there's this thing called economies of scale, where if a lot of people come together, you can afford more than you could. So a lot of places I've visited, they wouldn't be able to have a guest room in their house, but they can have a guest room in their community and their family can benefit from that.
You've got a great term for these kinds of small neighbourly opportunities, neighbourisms. Is that right?
Yes. So that's a word I've started using this last year. And it refers to these kind of small, informal, mutual acts of care, interest and connection that I think we've lost a lot of, but then also that they're really common in these communal living environments. They're just part of the way we do things. And neighbourism isn't just a nicety. It isn't just this cute, fluffy thing that's nice to have. It is the absolute core of a resilient society, because without that, like I said, you have to go to social services, to the government, to the authorities for anything, and you have to wait until stuff gets really, really serious. And neighbourisms build not only a web of care, but they build trust, they build belonging, they build safety.
All the essentials of home.
Yeah.
It's a great word. That's a really great word. I love that you've coined that. Is this just something that we're experiencing in the Western world? Because non-Western cultures still have huge kind of reliance, or that it's very everyday to have an intergenerational home. Is this just something that's a problem in the West, this idea of loneliness and detachment that we're trying to resolve somehow?
Yeah, I think so. And that's a great question. And I'm really aware that many First Nations and Aboriginal people, they have these models of kinship and community that I'm talking about. They have that naturally, which embody multi-generational support. And there's so much to learn from there. And I think in the West, we have kind of moved away from this extended family community support model. And that's why I think we need to be intentional about models like communal living, because we have lost it. And I think if we look at especially Western urban societies, I live in London, I visited a lot of urban spaces, that's where the art of neighbouring or neighbourisms, whatever you want to call it, has really, really been lost. And we are seeing severe poor mental and physical health impacts, rising loneliness, which is actually most chronic amongst people aged 16 to 25, which surprises people. So yeah, that's kind of been my focus in very kind of capitalist, westernised societies. how have these communal living models managed to spring up, managed to sustain, and how are they changing lives?
Look, I know that most of us still live in detached dwellings, 70% of us, in fact, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And you might be thinking, this is a pie-in-the-sky idea, something like the communes we looked at back in episode 2. But the fact is, those communes, their radical experiments are now addressing modern challenges of loneliness, the cost of living, and scarce resources. And they're working. By shifting the way we think just a little, we can build homes that help us live better. The communities that Savannah studied have made that shift, and their homes reflect that choice. The spaces were designed and built to nurture it.
There's no perfect blueprint, but there's a lot of things that come up again and again. So one is accessible housing, so making sure that it's appropriate for aging in place, so older people stay in, but also at the same time, on the other end of the spectrum, child friendly. So making sure that people can stay in their place throughout their life course. Having multi-purpose spaces is really important. So whether it's a common room or a green space, so that different groups, different size groups can do different activities in this space, and it's used often and people know it belongs to them. Green spaces are really important to bring people together and to make people want to go to a space. I visited one apartment block in Melbourne that have added a lot of green space into the apartment block to try and make people to try and get people out there and using the shared space.
Shared space, it's an idea we've heard before, but how does it actually work day to day? Savannah says that when people choose to live intentionally in this way, they carefully navigate the balance between privacy and connection.
So shared spaces such as shared laundry, shared workshops, shared communal kitchen, this kind of thing is all really popular, but also thinking really carefully about things like visibility. So I've seen examples where there's shared kitchens and dining spaces so that adults can connect, but there's a glass panel through to play areas so that they can still keep an eye on their children. It features that childcare element, but there's places for the adults to connect. And then things like post boxes, if you think about it, most people on the street, they'll each have a mailbox in their door. But if you put post boxes together, each day is an opportunity to have that casual, low social interaction with a neighbour and get to know each other.
That's how it can be done, with a lot of thought and planning. But what happens when your grown child won't or can't leave the nest, and your ageing parent needs to return to it? Dr. Edgar Liu says that most modern houses simply aren't designed to support multi-generational life.
Our housing is actually not suitable for this kind of arrangement because we've lost our understanding of how do we actually live with family members. I think it's not necessarily about the size itself, but maybe a bit more smarter design solutions. Part of the things that people found particularly challenging when it comes to privacy was that our homes tend to involve a lot of open plan spaces. So there's nowhere for you to hide from too much company, for example. There might be someone watching TV and it could be your older father and he's half deaf, so it needs to be on 35 volume all the time and the whole house shakes. But there's nowhere for you to hide from that aside from your own bedroom, if you have your own bedroom, that is. So we kind of need to have a bit more kind of flexible arrangement when it comes to our design. Yes, we can still have an open plan living dining area, but maybe build in a sliding door that you can close for half the time if you need to stay away from people, or an occasional nook that you can just go and hide and read a book, without needing the only private space that you can have is a bedroom or the bathroom.
Community and connection are essential to our well-being, but how do we foster belonging when we're always moving, when we're renters, not owners? How do we create a feeling of home for people who don't have the security of owning their own place? Matilda Leake is an associate director and design architect at Bates Smart. She specialises in apartment design, and as a millennial who's been locked out of the housing market herself, she's full of ideas of how we can make spaces feel more like home, no matter who holds the title.
When it comes to design, we need to have apartments that are 3-bedroom, that are 4-bedroom. We need to have apartments that they're called dual key. So there's a singular corridor with 2 front doors, but they can be joined in the event that you have a big family, intergenerational family members are living with you, etc., but it still feels separate. So these are the kind of diverse apartment typologies that just aren't getting built enough. But when they do, we're seeing people are able to rent longer. They're able to stay there, grow their families, and there's a bit more security around the flexibility of that.
So why aren't we building these types of apartments?
Because you can build more one beds in the same amount of floor plate than you can do 3 beds. So it becomes a financial costing, it's a product issue. And also, for most of Australia's history, that's all the market has wanted. That's all the people, the renters have wanted. But now we're seeing that change. And what's not catching up is developers offering bigger apartments now that people want them. There's more cultures in Australia that demand for different kinds of living. People want to rent their lives, but they are just not seeing that kind of stock available to them. So that's the sort of big scale.
With those design innovations you're talking about, you've mentioned more diversity and larger offerings. So it's not just that sort of transient moment in our lives, something we can kind of grow into. I'm also thinking about things like how design might be able to support stability and personalization and even ideas of community for lifelong renters. How does that work in that sort of higher density situation?
We're starting to now see it in Australia with the built-to-rent model, where we're designing big buildings with lots of apartments that are designed to rent, not sell. So developers are keeping the asset. And because of that, they're building better product, better quality, and they're also building more robust materials, and they're wanting their renters to stay longer. So they're trying to design them so that they will be happier for longer. So it comes down to some little things and some big things. So first of all, it's about the front door threshold. When you come home to your front door, you want to be greeted by something that is homely and that is usable. You don't want to be greeted by a big, long corridor with no light and no air. So we're looking at smaller corridors with good access to light and air so that you're meeting your front door in a homely, friendly way. Then we're looking at that threshold. So people need to put their prams, they need to put their shoes, things like their umbrellas. So actually building a little front threshold.
Like a vestibule, yeah?
A vestibule is actually really important. Little study nooks, really important. Interstitial places are really important for those things in life that you need that is beyond just the efficiency of a 3x3 bedroom, a living room and a kitchen. You need these smaller changeable spaces for a comfortable life and a long-term rent.
And I guess those are the things that get excised because they're not seen to be efficient.
They're not efficient. They're not required under the guidelines. So if they're not required, why would we do them? They're seen as a waste of space, et cetera, et cetera. One really good example of this is the front door space that I was talking about. But what we're starting to see and what we've actually done in projects is a front door that has the general security front door, but then you can put like a mesh or a grate over it and it lets you open your front door while still being secure and it lets a lot more light and air coming through your apartment that's aided by this new front door corridor that has light. And that is allowing better amenity into the apartments, but it's also fostering a sense of community. You start seeing your neighbours, you start seeing people walk by and you start seeing that interaction happen. So when we go back to some of these apartment buildings where we've done this, we say, what's your favourite thing? And we think that they'll say, oh, the pool or the, you know, the great kitchen or whatever. And actually what we're finding is that they're saying that the ability to open their front door and feel like it's a community, like you could if you owned a home or any larger property, getting that fresh air, seeing your neighbours, fostering that community is super important. And it's such a small thing that has had quite a big impact on how people live their lives and how people use these apartments.
It's a fundamental, isn't it, really? Yeah?
Absolutely. A fundamental, especially if you want to live long term. People buy places because they want to put down roots. But if you didn't need to buy a place to put down roots, if you could do that while, you know, greeting your neighbours, while allowing your children to have a study area, you know, putting your pram in a space without having it always in the one living room that you have. They're really important for making people feel comfortable, wanting to stay longer in rental apartments and fostering that community.
When you hear the statistic that 70% of people under the age of 35 can't imagine owning their own home in the future, how does that make you feel?
Oh, it's pretty sad. I mean, I'm one of them. It feels like I'm missing out on a milestone. It feels like I'm somehow behind the generation that was ahead of me and that somehow I'm doing it wrong and I'm failing and things like that. And you'll often get that from parents or older people, you know, what, just get in the market. Why didn't you do it? I did it. And it's not that simple. It's really hard to get your head around because we're so focused on this buying mentality in Australia. But at the same time, those of my friends that have bought or those of my colleagues that have bought, they're always talking about mortgages, building maintenance, plumbing that's gone wrong. And I just sometimes think, oh my God, I'm so glad I don't have to worry about that. And so I think there is a shift in what people expect their life to be. And actually the convenience of a rented space, renting a good space that accommodates your lifestyle, that you can put down roots, that you can stay for longer is really important. Things like providing a cold shell apartment, which means there's no kitchen and no wall finishings. What if you could come in and rent a place but bring your own kitchen? Amazing. They do that in Europe. They just don't do that here because you can't get tenancies that are long enough. But that would be amazing because it would make my space feel like my own. As an architect, of course, I want to do that. I want to build my own kitchen. I want to put in my own inbuilts. What if you just deliver a box and I can come in, rent that space and make it beautiful and I can stay there for 10 years? We should have that model here.
It's sounding like actually you're resigned in a way to the fact that you're going to be renting for a long time, but feeling quite optimistic about it.
I think you have to. Eventually I could buy a house, I could save up, I could do that. But I honestly don't know if it's needed, and I shouldn't think that I'm behind anyone else because I'm not doing it. I think actually I should look at the advantages that comes with the rented life and see it through that lens rather than what I'm missing out.
Matilda certainly paints a great picture of the possibilities of renting, one that holds a lot of promise. This build-to-rent model in particular sounds really inspiring. It's a relatively common phenomenon in the United States and the United Kingdom. In comparison, the build-to-rent model in Australia is minuscule, but it's growing. If only all apartments were designed with that level of care and thought. But apartment buildings are just one piece of a much bigger puzzle. We're talking about creating greater density, not just high-rises, but more terraces and other types of attached dwellings. It's about reimagining suburbs where you're no longer separated from your neighbours by a long driveway, high fences and a patch of lawn. Many in the world of design and architecture see this density as a positive step, one that, if done well, could help solve more than just the housing crisis. Craig Olchin is an architect and urban designer at 6 Degrees Urban. He has an idea for how an entire building could be used to solve the problem of housing flexibility, the Paris model.
The Paris model is really based on the idea that we're going to convert some existing homes into an apartment building. So you might take 3 or 4 or 5 lots in the middle ring suburbs. Typically in Sydney, the lots are 12 or 15 or 20 metres wide. You know, so you need to take a certain number of those and you'd build an apartment block on there. So if you were living in one of those homes, you might then go into one of the double-storey terraces that are on the ground floor of that.
Mm. And being Paris, 6 storeys we're talking?
Yeah. So you could move into that double-storey terrace and then over time the kids might move out. You might move into an apartment upstairs, which would be, there'd be some 3-bedroom apartments, 2-bedders, 1-bedders. Over time, the kids might move into one of the studios up on the very top because I think the studios could sit right along the top. A whole lot of studios would fit in an apartment block. And then as people age in place, which is one of the big challenges we have, you might even decide to move as an older person into one of those studios. And because you've originally had the terrace, you've got some money to get some support so you could live in that little studio, bring in the aged care and live and age in place properly rather than the fear of being sent off somewhere.
What so, you're describing is a kind of a multi-generational small rise, mid-rise
yeah.
kind of mixed-use development.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And I think it's the secret is the hyper-diversity. By having big double-storey terraces, it's like those big grand French apartments and then some regular apartments, 2 and 3 and 1 bedders, and then some tiny studios. So you're creating a diversity that would service real life and a real family life. And you know, say the family might also have the double story. Yes, one of the kids might move into a studio later on. And if you have different kind of shares in it, you could create enough value in it so you can rent that out rather than having a granny flat which gets used, you know, for a few years, and then it sits empty in our traditional detached house.
Flexible living within one building isn't a new idea. Jeremy McLeod from Breathe Architecture has long been designing homes that are sustainable, thoughtful, and built for well-being. Like Craig Olchin, he believes in smaller, more adaptable spaces and in the power of shared areas to foster connection. It's a philosophy shaped by his commitment to rethink what home means and how much space we actually need to live well.
Size has a massive implication for upfront carbon, how much carbon goes into it, but then also the carbon to operate the building, like how much energy it takes to heat and cool the building. And then, of course, that has an implication for the cost of living. How much does it cost you to heat and cool those houses? So size is actually becoming a massive burden, not only for the planet, but for the people that live in them.
Yeah. We're our own worst enemies in that sense. Our castles are killing us.
Yeah, correct. And also there's a massive market mismatch between how many people live on their own. So about 26% of Australians live on their own, but only about 5% of Australian homes are single-bedroom housing. So all of our houses are too big. And in fact, we're saying that there's a housing crisis. But, you know, at the last census, there was over 1 million houses that were empty. And there were over 13 million empty bedrooms.
Wow.
So there's actually enough houses to house everyone in Australia. And there's actually enough bedrooms to more than house everyone in Australia. So we don't need to have 122,000 people sleeping on the streets or sleeping rough. But there's a massive market mismatch around that.
Yeah. So let's talk about a smaller house then. You know, a smaller house is, we know is better for us, both physically and emotionally. A lot of people would disagree with that. They'd say, come on, a smaller house, that's going to be harder, isn't it? What would you say to that?
Well, so there's, it's all about design, efficiency, effectiveness. We've been working on small footprint homes in apartment buildings that might be 27 square metres. So not 236 square metres, but 27 square metres. So what's that? Like, you know, 14% of the size of the average Australian home. So why is that interesting? Some of those homes were sold recently for $215,000, the first home buyers to people under an income cap. And what are those people's experiences of living there? They live in an apartment building with shared amenity. So they've got a shared rooftop laundry. They have a shared dining space. They've got a shared barbecue space. They've got shared productive gardens. They've got a shared laundry. So they get to share all those things. They've got a shared bike parking space, a shared workshop, a shared car park with 14 different EVs in there. And what that allows those people to do is to be able to pay a mortgage off, secure housing security and safety, and then be able to live bigger by having all of these other things, just not in their traditional four walls. So they're able to kind of get access to that. In accessing that across other parts of the building, they're also able to meet other neighbours in the building.
Yeah.
And if they'd like to, they can build a community with those people if they want to. If they're highly introverted, they don't need to. But the amazing thing, Anthony, is that we thought that that would only appeal to, you know, 30-year-old nursing students or nursing graduates or young graphic designers starting their career. We thought it would be for young people starting their housing journey. But what we've found is that that is one cohort that's desperate to get out of the rental cycle and to find housing security. But the other cohort is older single women aged over 55, desperately trying to buy those properties because their ability to earn is diminishing over time. Their capital might be diminishing over time and they can't get a loan as they kind of get closer to retirement age. So this is kind of our fastest growing cohort of homelessness in this country is older single women. And we've got those women moving into these apartment buildings and building beautiful lives for themselves and beautiful community for themselves.
These are all exciting ideas, but will Australians actually embrace them? Savannah Fischel says it starts with rewriting the story we tell ourselves about housing. It's about shifting the narrative from isolation and ownership to connection and adaptability.
One of the underlying barriers to communal living is that the media and government often present isolated single family home ownership as the only valid aspiration, the only way to live. And I'm not saying living communally is going to work for every single person, but it's a valid aspiration and it should be encouraged and promoted, especially because of all the resources it saves. So there's something about culture and media and narrative that's really important before or kind of underlying all of the architectural and policy shifts, which I do talk about a little bit in my output.
The narrative question is so interesting. How do you think then we change that narrative?
I think it starts with the people that are often controlling narrative when it comes to government and media portrayals. I'm doing a lot of work in the UK trying to kind of bang the drum on communal living. But I think it starts with conversations like this in the media. Hopefully people are going to think about, maybe a lot of listeners have a lot of spare rooms and can even think about that. You know, Australia build some of the biggest houses in the world, on average 30% bigger than the UK. And a lot of rooms in a lot of those houses go unused. If that's even kind of becomes more of something in people's mind. Maybe people have an older parent or are thinking about their future and are thinking, wouldn't it be interesting to see what communal options out there? That's how the tide slowly starts to shift. It's in everyday people listening and talking about it. And then it's also in the government and the conversations they're having. And that bleeds down then into policy that supports communal living.
So the cultural shifts that we're talking about, we obviously need to make a cultural shift to embrace this more. Do you think those shifts are mostly social or political or even design? I mean, where do you see the big shifts needing to happen?
All of the above. Am I allowed to say that?
You are, absolutely.
I think there's a huge cultural shift, and I don't think you get policy change without cultural change. So you need that cultural change to give a reason for policymakers to listen up. And then policy change is many things. So often communal living doesn't have a policy home, and policies around housing, around financing housing, around building housing is all created around an idea of a nuclear family that often, even if that is people's preference, often is breaking down anyway. There's more single parent households than ever. So it's about creating a policy home so that it's easier for architects, it's easier for developers, it's easier for people who want to move in to find each other.
So it's all about cultural change. But for Jeremy McLeod from Breathe Architecture, real housing reform starts with bold government action. And that means rethinking how we tax property.
At the moment, you know, your accountant, everyone's accountant's going to tell them the single best asset that they can invest in is owning their own home, because they get, it's, you know, any bit of capital growth they get is tax-free. So if you had any other tax-free investment, everyone would say that you do that. And then we've built this mythology over time that we never build enough housing. So we're always in an undersupply situation, which always pushes demand, which always pushes prices up. So we're going to need a bold policy change by government to make our housing a basic human right, not an investable asset class.
In the end, none of this is going to work if the dollars don't stack up. For many Australians, housing isn't just shelter. It has become our biggest financial investment, and that shapes everything. So, can we actually shift the dial? What will it take to spark the policy changes needed for a fairer housing future? That's what we're exploring in the next episode of The Homefront.
Everyone wants house prices to go up. And also, nobody really, particularly in policy, describes what the aim of the policy is. Everyone talks about we need to fix housing affordability and we're increasing supply and we're going to build this many houses and so on. But that's all about the process. But the aim of the policy isn't stated. Like, what are we trying to achieve? Are we trying to keep house prices where they are in relation to incomes? Or are we trying to get house prices back to what they used to be in relation to incomes? Or would we settle for getting house prices back halfway to what they used to be? With climate change, the policy has a clear aim, which is net zero by 2050. So all policy is aimed at that. So what is the aim with housing? There isn't really a stated aim.
That was financial journalist Alan Koller, and he'll be joining us on the next episode. ABC Radio National's By Design and this series, The Homefront, is produced on Gadigal land and the lands of the Wurundjeri people. The producer is Siobhan Hunt, with thanks this week to Rachel Bongiorno. Ross Richardson is our sound engineer. The executive producer is Rhiannon Brown. Follow By Design with me, Anthony Burke, on ABC Listen. If you're listening via podcast, leave us a review so others can find the program. And we love hearing from you. Get in touch with the team by emailing us at bydesign@abc.net.au. While the Homefront series is on air, Extraordinary Everyday won't be in the broadcast, but you can still get your fix. There's a new episode waiting for you in the By Design podcast feed. Just follow us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, because in a rapidly changing world, design matters.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.